to our feet and let's just give Chad just a big woohoo.
Yes. All right, here we go. We have a lot to do this morning. You guys ready? Yes. So I'm Chad. So good to be here, and it's true. I mean, this is Andy and Matt and Renee and Diana. Like, they're just some of our favorites in the planet. Like, just. I mean, you have bonding experiences when you travel, and I'll never forget I think I got picked up from the airport, and last time I was here, and these guys put a seed in my heart, telling me about one of the longest left point breaks in the planet, and called Shippies, Shipwreck Bay, and I was exhausted, I was a little jet lagged, I had just arrived, and. And these guys took me on a crazy adventure where we went up to Shipwreck Bay after arriving from California. And I was a little exhausted. I was a little tired. But, man, there was just this bonding. We just laughed. We laughed, like, pretty much the whole time. And it was, you know, there's just something about being with your friends and just laughing and surfing together and hooting and hollering. I mean, these two guys love to hoot and holler, and they know me. I love to hoot and holler. And there's just something about that, like the bond with surfers hooting and hollering on one another. And, you know, Brandon's gone. Brandon's somewhere, but he's taking care of the girls. But you know, I just love being with my friends in the water, being with my friends in the car, being my friends, you know, where we're at church together. Like, we're running together. It's all the same. Like, it's not a different deal. It's I'm the same person in a car and Shipwreck Bay here in the church and, you know, just hooting and hollering. Like, I just love, like, you know, just going, like, Andy's like, you know, going, hey, all the time. And all of a sudden, I'm like, oh, I just love that. That just feels like my brother, you know? Like, you know, I just want to, like, go, hey, all the time with him. I'm like, yeah, let's do it together, you know? That's awesome. So it really is an honor and a privilege for me and for my wife as well. And we just love doing life with these guys and love doing life with you guys. And I remember coming here, I think it was like the first year you guys had planted. And so, you know, been with you guys for 6 years, even though I haven't been back in 4 years, I just haven't been back to New Zealand. That has nothing to do with anyone from any churches in New Zealand. I've just been really busy. And I just can't believe time flies. I just need to be a little more intentional. And I'm just so excited I get to be here right now in 2017. And last night was last night. It was a moment for me, you know, that's, I love it. I love it when people get rocked, and I love it when I get rocked. And I got rocked last night, and it was just, I think there was a puddle over here, like right here. That was my puddle, and snot everywhere. And so those are really good meetings when the speaker has snot everywhere. And so anyways, it was just one of those special nights. But anyways, we're excited. Can't wait. We got resources in the back. Just go get them. Here's the Risk Factor. It's an awesome book. My dad and I tag teamed, and we had so much fun. In that, one of the chapters is my wife and I, we did a trip around the world, and we went for 18 months. The beginning of the recession in 2008 in America, we quit our jobs, our salary positions, and said, we're just going to go. We're going to go around the world and just preach the gospel and just like go into countries and get to know the culture, get to know people, get to like stay in homes. We stayed out in the bush. You call it the bush because, you know, everyone's gone to the bush, but not many people have been to the bush. And so we were in Mozambique with Heidi and Roland, and Heidi and Roland's a huge father, mother in our lives. And Andy talked about impartation. And, you know, one of the greatest ways to get impartation from someone's life is doing life with them, is being a friend, running with them, doing life. Like, if you want the greatest impartation from someone, do life with them. That it's this valuing them way beyond their gifting, their anointing. It's valuing them as a person, valuing their heart, valuing, you know, and walking life out with them. And that's what you saw with Elijah and Elisha. You know, Elijah and Elisha, they were doing life together, and Elisha received a double portion of what was on Elijah's life because they ministered together. They ran together. And I love that. I love just doing life with people. And it's the same way with those that are fathering and mothering me or those that I'm able to pour into. And Heidi has just been a huge mom. And I'll never forget, we're on this trip around the world and we're in Fiji. And we call Heidi on Skype in 2009. And we're talking, we're prophesying over one another. We're getting caught up in each other's lives. And we're praying for one another. We're laughing together. It was like 1 a.m, and we just have this amazing time with Mama Heidi in Fiji on Skype. And then the next morning, I'm preaching. And, you know, I preached on the Father's love, and I said, hey, if you're sick, if you have pain in your body, come on up here. We believe that, you know, God's the healer, and you just encountered, like, the Father's love and everything. So come on up here if you need healing. And I prayed for this lady. And she was blind, and if you know Heidi Baker's story, Randy Clark gave her a prophetic word that she would have an authority and an anointing for blind eyes to open, and I watched her for 2 years where we would go and travel together to the East Coast or, you know, Southern California or Mozambique, and I'd watch her pray for people with blind eyes with so much conviction, so much like this is the moment that a breakthrough, and then nothing would happen. And I just watched her navigate this place of breaking off disappointment, discouragement, and just believing every time she prayed for the next blind person. Like we were in Pennsylvania together driving. She's driving the car. I'm in the passenger seat. And she goes, look, there's a blind person walking on the street. And she, like, pulls up on the sidewalk. Like, that's illegal. So come on, Chad, let's go. And I'm like, yeah, let's do it, you know. And so we run him down, and we pray for him, and he doesn't get healed. And she's like, all right, next time, I'm going for it. Next time, the next time is going to be the breakthrough. And I just watched her, like, live in this place of faith, this seed of faith that she got this prophetic word. And she's like, I've got it. I have an authority. I have an anointing for blind eyes to open. And I watched her contend. I watched her cultivate. I watched her fight for this breakthrough. And into 2 years, she's in Mozambique, and she says, all right, if you're blind, come on up here. And this lady comes up who's blind. Her eyes open, and we find out that her name is Mama Ida, which Heidi Baker is known in Mozambique as Mama Ida. And the first five peoples that she prays for, their eyes that open, the first five breakthroughs of eyes opening, their names were Mama Ida. So with that in mind, I pray for this lady who has cataracts, completely blind for over 3 years. Her eyes open, and I go, well, I never got your name. What is your name? And she goes, it's Mama Ida. And so here's the deal. Here's the point of what I'm talking about. It's Heidi Baker. It would have been amazing. This would have been awesome, but it didn't happen this way. Is if we were talking on Skype the night before in Fiji, and she goes, oh my gosh, I'm hearing the Lord. The Lord is saying that you're going to meet a lady, and she's blind with cataracts, and I have this anointing. I give you this inheritance. I give you impartation. What I fought for, I give to you freely. What's awesome is she didn't have to say that because I was already receiving impartation. I was already getting the inheritance by being a son, by doing life with Mama Ida and Papa Roland. And so I pray for this lady. I never met another Heidi, Ida, Mama Ida in Fiji for there for a month. It's not a coincidence that I pray for this lady who has cataracts 2 years, completely blind, and then her eyes open. And her name is Mama Ida because I received an impartation from doing life with someone. So do life with people. I guess that's a good segue. Yeah, that story is in the book, but I guess it's a good segue because I'm going to talk about doing life with people. That's what I'm going to talk about tonight. I'm going to talk about covenant relationship. I'm going to talk about, and when we think of covenant relationship, a lot of us think of our covenant with God. Like if someone you know is starting to, you know, do drugs or They're like running around with the opposite sex or whatever. They're like living in sin. And they're like, oh my gosh, like, what do we do? Like, let's send them prophetic words. Let's, you know, take them out to coffee and say, hey, what's going on in your life? Like, how are you doing? I love you. You know, don't blow up the bridge. Don't blow up the covenant that you have with God. Right? Yeah. And then we have marriage. And the Christian world is pretty, you know, like, hey, we're going to fight for marriages. Don't blow up that covenant. Don't blow up that bridge. Yes. But why is it in the church when there's friends that maybe disagree or they talk behind each other's back or there was this blow up of the bridge and sometimes we get counsel of like, hey, maybe you should go find some other friends. You weren't meant to have best friends for a season. You weren't meant to have BFFs for 3.5 years and there to be some kind of blow up, some kind of maybe you got hurt or maybe, you know, somebody, you know, hurt you or, you know, or maybe you hurt somebody. You like, man, I like blew the bridge up on that one. Like, ah, we were never meant to only have friends for a season. We were meant to have friends for eternity. To do life with someone, to share your dreams with someone, your prophetic words, laugh together, cry together, and then something happens to blow up, to come between you, and it's like, oh, I got to go find another friend to do it all over again. That was never God's original design. Like, you know that he created relationships to be inconvenient. How many marriages in here know this? But there's something about in the inconvenience. I got maybe don't put your hand up. but that's the deal, right? Like there's moments of inconvenience in our relationship with God. There's moments of inconvenience in our marriage. There's moments of inconvenience in our friendships. And there's some. It's in the dynamic. It's in the DNA. It's just a part of the makeup of covenant and relationship. Because it's something of value that when there is a hurt and you choose to forgive and you actually are powerful people and you talk it out and you share your heart, you share, man, that really was hurtful. You become vulnerable. There's something that happens as you do that that builds equity in the relationship. That if you choose love, past hurt, disappointment, that's equity in the relationship. All right, you guys are looking at me with that tone of voice. Let's make this legal. Turn with me to John 13. John 13, verse 34. Jesus speaking to the disciples. A new commandment I give to you that you love one another, even as I have loved you, that you also love one another. By this all men will know that you are my disciples if you have love for one another. So this is just a very generalized statement. This is definitely a very generalized statement. But the world, what do they say about the church? The world is like, man, the church can't get along. They can't agree on anything. They shoot their wounded. They're all separated in different camps. Jesus is saying, a new commandment I give to you that you love one another. I know this is going to like freak out all the evangelists in the room, but can we just forget about loving the world for a moment? What if we were to love one another? Because Jesus is saying, if you want to see the greatest harvest in the world, it starts by us loving one another as modeling a love that's never been seen or modeled in the world. Because it comes from the author of love, the God of love. Sorry, I'm being too loud for the little guy. There's an awakening happening. I mean, Jesus is saying, hey, the world will know you're my disciples and how you love one another. If you, like, I'm speaking to the evangelists now. If we want to see one of the greatest harvests ever in the world, it will come from a place of how we model love in the church. Love one another. So, like, what is love? This, you know, we have this love that Jesus is saying, love one another. And then he keeps going. You know, it's not like there was different chapters in Jesus, you know, in John writing this, like, okay, hey, that's separated. Like, as you go on through John 13, 14, and then 15, in John 15, 13, Jesus begins to talk about the greatest manifestation of love. The greatest manifestation of love is that you lay down your life for your friends. And Jesus became this message. He laid down his life for his friends. I mean, let's think about this for a second. Like, I believe that he had me in mind. He had you in mind. But I think when that nail was getting deeper and deeper, he started thinking about Peter, James, and John. Because those are the guys that he did life with. Those were the guys that were his friends, his inner circle. Those are the guys that he ate fish tacos with, slept in caves with. He just did life with. And when that nail was getting deeper and deeper, he's like, I'm doing this for you because we have equity. I mean, let's just think about, like, sometimes we got the red letters of Jesus, and it's like, okay, you know, the Holy Spirit's on him, and, you know, like, this is, like, what he has to do. And we forget about the human side of Jesus, the emotional, like, struggle or turmoil, where he says to his best friend, Peter, in the upper room, yeah, even you, Peter, are going to deny me. And you kind of think like, yep, that's a done deal then, you know, like it's just, you know, but let's think about what that was like for Jesus carrying the cross up the hill, and he sees a mob of people around his friend, and he hears the rooster crow, and he's looking at Peter, and what is Peter doing? This mob of people are like, hey, we've seen you with this guy, Jesus. Don't you know this guy, Jesus? Isn't he your friend? And Peter is blowing up the relational equity that he has with his best friend, Jesus. I don't know the man. You're getting me confused with someone else. We don't have any relational equity. We don't have a heart connection. He is blowing up the bridge. And Jesus is going to the cross with that in mind. And what is Jesus' first action of being resurrected? He comes across Mary and he goes, Mary, sorry, I can't talk to you. I'm here to go and see my friend. I need to go and find my friend Peter, because when I left this planet, he blew up our bridge. So I need to go and see my friend Peter. And Peter is out fishing. He doesn't even realize, hey, this is like an opportunity, he doesn't know that this is an opportunity coming of restoration. And Jesus comes to the banks of the Sea of Galilee, and there's Peter, and he sees Jesus, and he jumps out of the boat. His response of restoration is like, oh my, I didn't even know this was an opportunity, like, I didn't know that this could happen. He jumps in the water and swims to Jesus, and he's like, hey, I want to restore this bridge. It's one of the most beautiful stories of restoration. I know a lot of people, and it's totally, you know, accurate and biblical that to preach how Jesus was restoring Peter back into ministry and, you know, feed my sheep, but I think it was even bigger than that. It was this place of friendship. You blew up the bridge, but it's okay. That's who I am. I'm the God of restoration. But we've done life together. You know, I love being a part of Bethel Church. And what's amazing about Bethel and our leaders is they've been doing life together for decades. And there's something about, like, I love suddenlies. Absolutely love suddenlies. But there's something about time. There's something about time that you can't fast forward. There's something about time that you can't, like, manufacture. You know, like, I thought I knew what love was when I was dating. And I did. I experienced love from my perspective. Like, what was love? And then I got married. And that first couple years of marriage was amazing, and I was like, I'm growing in love. But there's something about those that have been married for 40 years, that they have a different perspective, that they have equity of 40 years of doing life, of doing relationship. Like, there was probably some inconvenient moments in that 40 years, and they said yes. And so we have this, you know, at Bethel, where you're like, Bill and Chris, like, you know, they just did life together. Danny Silk, Charlie Harper. You know, Danny Silk came out with a book, The Culture of Honor, and he talks about the establishment of apostles and prophets and this whole deal. And so I've been into a couple of, like, church, you know, retreats or church leadership meetings, and they'll come to me and say, hey, we read The Culture of Honor, and, you know, we all took a vote, and we all found out I'm the apostle, which is really cool. And our senior associate was the prophet, so that worked out well. And we're just wondering, do you know of any, like, unemployed fivefold pastors wandering the hallways of Bethel Church that we could hire? Because we need a fivefold pastor now. And I look at them and I go, hey, you should probably go check your local butcher shop, because that's where your pastor's probably hiding. Because that's where Danny Silk was hiding. Danny Silk was a butcher that, you know, a butcher, right? Is that translates well into New Zealand? Okay, good. You know, Chris Valentin was a mechanic. Charlie Harper was a real estate agent. And Bill was a pastor of 200 people. And they just did life together for decades that way. And I tell the now apostle, I said, hey, also, will you just pour into Danny Silk, the butcher, before he ever comes, Danny Silk, the pastor, and you pour into him for 20 years before he ever comes into being the fivefold pastor? And just do life. I remember graduating first year of school ministry in 2003, and Bill Johnson said, hey, what do you want to take, you know, into the next year for those that were going on to second year? And, like, and people started saying, hey, I want to go on more trips with you, Bill. I want to get to know Chris Valentin more, and, you know, all this different stuff. And the Lord speaks to me and says, Chad, look behind you. Look to your left and right. That is tomorrow's Bill and Chris. Invest now. So that was Joaquin Evans, that was Chris Overstreet, that was a number of different people that I have had relationship with for 15 years, since 2002. 15 years. And I was only in the school ministry for 3, and then I left to go to Southern California. I'm not talking about just inconvenience in the areas of, oh, that person talked behind my back or whatever. The inconvenience of sometimes geographically, we're not in the same place. That's inconvenient to have a relationship thrive. So we were very intentional. Like, Joaquin would drive down to Southern California. I would go up to Redding. We would plan on, like, okay, let's go do 3 ministry trips together. Me and Chris Overstreet, he started in the School of Evangelism. I said, hey, I will go with you as long as Stephanie goes with you, his wife, and my wife goes, and we go on at least 2 double dates. Because that is one of the main reasons I'm going, is because, hey, I'm stewarding this relationship. I want to say yes to this relationship. I want moments with you that begin to build equity in our memorial stones of our relationship together. Fight for relationships. Fight for friendships. It's not a coincidence who's sitting next to you, who's sitting behind you. People are looking around. Do life with people. And sometimes we meet people and they rub us a little the wrong way. Sometimes we go on God TV or we go on TBN and we watch a minister and we're like, oh my golly, that is not my cup of tea. And just let me give you a little cheat sheet. That person might have something so valuable that you so desperately need. And that if you let that seed of offense come in there, it will totally sabotage what God is trying to give you. Let me give you an example. I was traveling with Bill to Cheon's church at Harvest Rock, and I was in second year, and I had grown up in Southern California, and so this is a church in Southern California. And I have a lot of friends. I grew up next to a seeker-sensitive church that, you know, kind of doesn't believe in the gifts. And I have a lot of friends that went to that church in Costa Mesa in Southern California. And so I told them, hey, like, it just makes sense. Like, Bill Johnson, you know, to people that, like, are that don't believe in healing or don't believe in the gifts of spirit, you hear Bill like once and healing just makes sense. And so I'm like, okay, I'm going to set up my friends for success. And I invited them to this conference to go hear Bill. And they're like, I invited about 12 or 14 of them. And they all had to cancel that night. And I'm like, okay, hey, well, come tomorrow night. Heidi Baker's going to be there. And I'm thinking, well, that's a little bit more of a risk because she's going to probably, like, lay on the ground and say Shabba for about 30 minutes. But then she's going to probably, like, share some crazy stories. And you can't deny the fruit of God just coming and just crashing into a nation. Shabba. Schnockered. So I'm like, okay, I invited them to that night, and they couldn't come. So they said, hey, we could all come Sunday night. And I'm like, okay, well, who's speaking Sunday night? And it's this lady, Jill Austin. And I'm like, okay, well, Jill Austin. All right, I don't know who she is. I know she's like a prophetess. This is 2003. And so I invite my friends, they come, and Jill starts off the night. The Lord has spoken to me. He has given me the mandate. There's people here who are pregnant in the spirit. And I pray, let the birth thing start, God. And it was crazy because, like, all of the older gentlemen in their, like, 60s and stuff were around my friends. And they all went into sudden birthing of revival babies. And they're like, "Wah!" And Jill goes, get in birthing positions. And so these like grown men, yeah, grown men are squatting. Good. Yeah, you want to come up here and show everybody? I mean, like there was guys laying on the ground with their legs up. And Jill goes, where are the midwives? Raise up the midwives, God. Where are the midwives? And so other grown men were grabbing the ankles of like these men birthing revival babies. And so my friends, they grabbed me and they're like, hey, Chad, like we came here tonight because we all thought you're a part of a cult. And you need to come with us. And I'm thinking in my head, maybe I am a part of a cult. And so I grab them and I say, hey, just look at me. Don't look behind me. I have no idea what the heck is going on over here. But just, you know me, you could trust me. And I said, hey, let's go on to the side room. And I had a couple other second year students with me. And I said, hey, let's go in the side room and put on these white robes and drink this crazy juice. No, I'm joking. I took them to the side room and we just started prophesying over them. And God just showed up like crazy. Totally backed us up. But as leaving that night of ministry, I was like, hey, I really don't connect with Jill Austin's ministry. That's not my cup of tea. Like, that's not my mandate to go and, like, awaken revival babies, get people to birth babies of revival in the spirit realm. That's just not my ministry. So I can honor from afar. Like, you know, like, hey, that's amazing. You go and do that. I'm going to be over here doing what I'm called to do, and that's awesome. And about 6 months later, I go and have a meal with a friend in Orange County. And he goes, hey, I have a real special surprise for you. I brought this lady. Her name is Jill Austin. I think she has something for your life. And everything in me was like, I've got to get out of here. I think I have a doctor's appointment, a dentist appointment. I've got to have an excuse to get out of this lunch. And I hear the Lord say, Chad, are you going to let offense keep you from getting what I'm trying to give you? The decision's up to you. And I'm like, okay, you know what? I need to go and do this lunch. And I begin to ask her questions. I begin to discover her heart. I begin to discover what God has done in her life. And as that is happening, my heart is connecting with this lady, Jill Austin. We begin to cry together. We begin to laugh together. And she says, Chad, will you prophesy over me? And I start prophesying over her. And then she starts prophesying over me. And then she opens up her journal. And she was a part of IHOP. She was a part of the Kansas City Prophets. And she would run with Mike Bickle and Bob Jones and James Gall. And so she opens up her journal, and she was in prayer at Kansas City 10 years earlier from this date. And she opens her journal, and she says, I want you to read this. And she was never married. She never had kids in the natural. And the Lord spoke to her 10 years earlier of me meeting her. And God speaks to her and says, you have two spiritual sons named Sean and Chad. And she looks at me with tears in her eyes. And she says, I've been waiting for you for 10 years. And she became one of the greatest moms of my life. She would take Julia out to breakfast and say, hey, this is the stuff that I've had to deal with being a woman in ministry. I want to give you wisdom that you don't have to go through the same hits that I've gone through. And she began to just impart to us. She would say, begin to tell me, Chad, you're a forerunner, you're a pioneer, you're a catalytic revivalist. These are the things that I've gone through, the hardships or the, you know, the misunderstandings, the control. I don't want you to have to go through the same things. Let me give you wisdom. She would have me come and speak at her conferences. I was 23 years old. And I could have completely sabotaged that if I would have let offense, if I would have let misunderstanding, if I would have let a judgment come into my heart. I would have missed out on one of the greatest moms of my life. We're called to run together. We're called to love one another. We're called to receive from one another, to give away what we have to one another, and to do life. Whether you're Danny Silk the butcher or Danny Silk the pastor, we're just doing life. We're connected to each other's hearts. I'll never forget, I was engaged to Julia, and I had been praying, God, give me revelation about marriage. And so I have a dream. I have a dream that Julie and I are married. It's 2018, and Julie went to Brazil. I went to India, and this angel, I'm in heaven, this angel is writing down my life, and he's saying, Chad, in like November 15th of 2018, saw 10,000 people healed in Brazil and 10,000 people saved in India. And I tell the angel, whoa, you're a little confused. That was Julia in Brazil, and I was the one in India. And he starts laughing at me. He goes, no, you don't understand. In heaven, when we see you, we see both of you. Like you are one in the spirit. Her breakthrough is your breakthrough. The fruit that she gets is your fruit. So I was like, wow, I have to have the spirit of stupid to not empower my wife and set her up for success to step into her destiny, because when she steps into her destiny, I step into my destiny. But that's not restricted just to marriages. David and Jonathan, they were friends. They were connected, knitted at the soul and the heart. Let's just look at 1 Samuel. I want to just break your paradigm a little bit about covenant, because we have covenant with God. We have covenant with our spouses. You know, back in Israel days, in the old covenant, they would have business partners where they'd slaughter a lamb. They would hold hands and walk through the blood of the lamb, making like a business covenant together. But us friends, we have covenant. I mean, I'm not saying obviously my priority is my covenant with God. Like, that's my number one priority. And then my second priority is my marriage with my wife. And then my third priority would be my covenant with my kids. And then I have this priority of, hey, I have, but they're not in competition with one another. They are flowing together. I'm making sure all those systems are going. I'm making the right kind of investments with my time, with my energy, into those and that priority system. They're all valuable to me. That if one is broken, if one is the bridge is blowing up, I'm like, uh-oh, okay, we need to all hands on deck. They're all valuable to me. 1 Samuel 18, verse 1. Now it came about when he had finished speaking to Saul that the soul of Jonathan was knit to the soul of David, and Jonathan loved him as himself. Saul took him that day and did not let him return to his father's house. Then Jonathan made a covenant with David because he loved him as himself. Jonathan stripped himself of the robe that was on him and gave it to David with his armor, including his sword and his bow and his belt. So what's going on there other than Jonathan stripping down? We watch this covenant, this knitting of the heart. But let's think about Jonathan for a second. Let's think about his identity of being the king's son, of being the prince. Like, he is born with this identity of, you are next in line to be king. He has scribes, he has teachers, he has, you know, all these mentors, all these people that are helping him, setting up for him for success and reinforcing the identity. You are prince, you are the next king. We are training you. He's having meals with his dad, Saul, at the breakfast table, the dinner table, and he's saying, hey, son, this is how I carry myself as king. This is his whole identity. The robe that he took off, whoever sees in the country of Israel, whoever sees wearing this robe, they are. It signifies that you are the next king of Israel. So Jonathan, his whole identity is to be the next king of Israel, and he sees David kill Goliath, and he's like, oh, wow, this anointing I've been cultivating, stewarding my whole life is not for me, it's for this guy, David. And when you have covenant friendships, covenant relationships, it breaks off insecurities, it breaks off performance, it breaks off breaks off the enemy. It breaks off competition. That I love David, I love Joseph, and the characteristics that they carried and the attributes they carried that revealed Jesus, but Jonathan carried one of the craziest characteristics of Jesus, that he laid down his life for his friend. He's like, wait a second. No, this isn't on me. It's on this guy, David. And this alliance that you're forming, God, this covenant that you're forming, this relationship you're forming, is perfect that you would connect, that you would align my heart with this guy, David, because my mission now is to set David up for success, because his breakthrough is my breakthrough. We're connected in the heart that when him being the greatest king is like me being the greatest king. But there's moments of inconvenience. There's a lot of moments when Jonathan could have done nothing and David would have been killed. But he fought for David. He fought for their friendship. Let's just look really quick at 1 Samuel 20. You guys doing okay? 1 Samuel 20, verse 30. Then Saul's anger burned against Jonathan, and he said to him, "You son of a perverse, rebellious woman." That's pretty, that's like, you know, that's not good. That's some bad mama jokes, you know, like that's just not, you don't do that. Like what is Saul doing? He's trying to trigger an emotional reaction in Jonathan that to cause him to make a really bad decision. He's like, what are you doing choosing the household of Jesse? What are you doing? Do I not know that you are choosing the son of Jesse to your own shame and to the shame of your mother's nakedness? Like, he's trying to stir up in Jonathan an emotional reaction. Verse 31, "For as long as the son of Jesse lives on the earth, neither you nor your kingdom will be established. Therefore now send and bring him to me, for he must surely die." So what is going on? He's trying to give his son the wrong kind of generational inheritance. He's saying, son, I had my opportunity for my kingdom to be established forever, and I messed that up, as we, you know, have read before in 1 Samuel, where he was surrounded by the Philistines, and he had the ace in his sleeve of the prophet Samuel. And Samuel said, I'll be here at this time. And Samuel didn't show up, and we all know prophets aren't late. They're right on time. And so he was like, okay, I got a good idea. Because of a fear of man directing his life, He's like, okay, I know how to get God to come. I will manipulate God, which is witchcraft. And he said, let's do some sacrifices. I know how to get God to come and deliver me from this uncomfortable situation. And so right when the sacrifices go up, Samuel shows up right on time and says, bummer, this was your opportunity for your kingdom to be established forever. And then suddenly the story changes in 1 Samuel from Saul to David. And so Saul is telling his son, this is your opportunity, son. Don't choose the house of Jesse. Don't choose David. You are the next in line to be king. Let's kill this guy together. And Jonathan's like, you know what, Dad? You're completely right. This is my opportunity for my kingdom to be established forever. That's why I'm connected to the heart of David, because we're one. His breakthrough is my breakthrough. I'm laying down my life for my friend. But this is like an inconvenient decision. Like, he loved his dad. He died with his dad. Jonathan loved his dad. But he's like, sorry, Dad, I have to choose my friend David, because we are connected at the heart. Friendship is a real big deal to me. My parents would always say when I was 3 years old, 4 years old, they would go play tennis and they would drop me in the playground, and the tennis courts were right there next to the playground, and they would, you know, get done playing tennis and they would see me. I'd have like 10 people and we'd be playing games and, you know, all this stuff. I was like friends with everyone. They would say everywhere we went, you just make friends with everyone. I love friends. I love having friends in my life. It's something that I have a huge value for. It's something that I've fought for. And I'll never forget being a teenager. And my parents had a pretty crazy church 24/7. A lot of drug addicts, prostitutes, witches getting saved. And there was this family that got radically saved. And they had lost their dad to cancer. And mom was addicted to painkillers. And the mom gets radically saved. And she has two boys that are out of the house, and then she has two other boys that are my age, in the areas of my same age and then a year younger. And these guys become my brothers. Their names are Chris and Vinny. And me and Vinny get the closest. And we're like brothers. Like, we would go surf together. If I was out of the house, they would stay in my bedroom. Like, if I was on a basketball tournament, you know, tour or something like that, they would come over to my house and eat the food and stay, you know, like they were like adopted into the family. And so they started getting influenced by their older brothers, and their older brothers were doing drugs. And they started doing drugs, and they would, you know, ask me, hey, do you want to get high? Do you want to? And I'm like, no. And then suddenly one day I'm like, you know what? Sure. And I started getting in this place of rebellion where I was rebelling against my parents. I was rebelling against God. And I started doing drugs. And then I started getting heavily into drugs when I was 13 years old. Yeah, this is your special speaker. But we did life together. Wasn't the best life to be doing. But there was this friendship. There was this bond. And we got caught drinking alcohol. And my parents said, you can't hang out with Vinny and Chris anymore. And you know, when you tell that to a teenager, that's like fanning the flames. And so I would sneak out of the house and go hang out with Chris and Vinny. And about a month later, we got caught doing drugs again. My parents were on date night, and we were at my house. My parents come home early, and they see me and Vinny goes running through the backyard and jumps over my neighbor's fence, and my dad finds, like, all these drugs, and, you know, my mom's crying, my son's a drug addict, and I go up to my bedroom, and it's about 2 a.m. now, and Jesus walks into my bedroom and said, you're either going to be my best friend, I'm 14 years old, you're either going to be my best friend, or I'm going to hand you over to Satan. And I knew that there was a hedge of protection on my life. See, I would do drugs, I would get high, and I would see Jesus in the corner weeping. And I'd be like, hey, I'm making my own decision. I'm doing my own thing. And I had a number of times where I almost was killed. I was, you know, dealing drugs. And there was a time when there was another drug dealer came up to shoot me. He took a gun to my temple and pulled the trigger, and the gun jammed. There's another time I was in a stolen car. Yep, again, special speaker. Anyways, there's another time that I was in a stolen car, and the car stalled, and so I went. The moment I went down to go check the wires, the window shattered because there was bullets flying in. So I knew that there was a hedge of protection in my life. And I knew that I was in a crossroads. I was in a moment where if I were to deny Jesus now, that hedge of protection would be lifted, and Satan wouldn't just let me just flounder through life as a drug addict, that he would have full access and right to kill me. And so I just look at Jesus and I say, I know you're the only way, the truth, and the life. I want you to be my best friend. He put his arms around me, and that spirit of addiction just lifted off, and I became a new creation. All that rebellion lifted off, and I became a new creation. So that was a Saturday night. I come to church pumped on Sunday morning, like, I'm ready to worship. I'm a new creation. And when you become a new creation after blowing up some bridges in your past, some are, like, you know, not everyone gets the memo. So my parents are a wreck, you know, from the stage, and like, my son's a drug addict. And this lady came up and spit right in my face and said, you make me sick. You're ripping your family apart. You're just a stupid drug addict. And I look at her, I'm like, you're talking about my old man. He died like 12 hours ago. Like, I'm a new creation. That's not me. But I had some rebuilding of equity to do. And so that afternoon, my dad calls me up to his room and he says, where is it? Where's the money? It was just his birthday, and someone gave him a good amount of money for a new pool table. And it was gone. And now you need to know, I stole from my parents like many times, but I did not steal this money. I didn't steal it because I didn't know it was there, to be honest. But the truth is, I didn't steal it. And my dad begins to interrogate me of like, well, then who else would have taken it? And I'm like, well, Vinny was here last night. Maybe it was Vinny. So we go to Vinny's house. He's gone. And my dad, like, you know, my dad says to me, you know where Vinny is. Like, you know, where do you guys all go hang out? And we would go hang out at this one house. And so I'm tell them, and we pull up, and there's Vinny and all of my other friends. And I mean, we're doing some pretty hardcore drugs, and these guys are pretty hardcore. Like, we go get in fights for fun. And my dad looks at me, and you need to understand, my dad was fighting for my life. So maybe he didn't go about it the best way, but his intention was fighting for his son's life. So he looks at me and he says, Chad, I want you to go and confront Vinny, and I want you to beat him up. Pastor Kevin Dedman. So I am in this, like, I'm in this quandary. Like, I'm in this, like, okay, what do I do? Like, I've got the WWJD bracelet. Like, what would Jesus do? I don't think he would beat the living tar out of Vinny. Like, what do I do, Jesus? Like, help me. I'm a new creation now. Like, this is not the best game plan. So my dad walks up. Me and my dad walk up. There's about 20 guys. And he goes, my son here is going to beat Vinny up. And if any of you have a problem with that, and Vinny's brother is there, Chris, who I'm friends with as well. If any of you have a problem with that, you could fight my son right now. I don't care if it's all of you, but if you're not going to fight my son, you need to leave right now because we have some business to take care of with Vinny. And they all look at my dad. My dad's veins are popping out. And they all look at me. And they all look at Vinny. And they all look at each other. And they all leave and walk away. And so we confront Vinny. And Vinny just, begins to just weep and cry. Like, I didn't take that money. And, you know, Kevin, you've been like a spiritual dad to me. Like, you know, I wouldn't do that to you. All this sort of stuff. And somehow I get out of beating up Vinny, which was awesome. But the damage has been done. Like, if you look at Vinny's perspective, he's pretty hurt. His whole spiritual family just got blown up. And he feels like his best friend, his brother, just threw him under the bus. That I was the first to, you know, to rat him out and say it was Vinny. So Vinny is pretty hurt, pretty disappointed. He calls my dad the next day, and he knows how to get back at me. He calls my dad the next day and says, hey, I did take the money. It was me and your son. And Vinny actually had taken that money. And, you know, he had bought a bike and the whole deal. But he knew that this would just wreck the relationship between me and my dad. And it did for a season, for about a couple years. And it really hurt me where I felt completely betrayed because I never took that money. My dad hung up the phone and said, the little thread of trust I had with you is now gone. And so the hurt that I had with my dad, I funneled it towards anger and hatred towards my brother, Vinny. I would have dreams about beating him up, about killing him. I'm going into my freshman year of high school, and it was in the end of my freshman year, and I saw Vinny, and I beat him up. This is only, don't worry, this is only like 4 months ago. It's not a big deal. No, this is just me being vulnerable. This is just me just telling you, hey, this is my life. These are the giants that I had to face at 14 and 15 years old. So my sophomore year of high school, I'm 15 years old, and I went to this Christian concert on New Year's Eve, Third Day, Supertones, you know, all those mid to late 90s Christian bands. And I'm coming back from this concert with my youth group, and I'm in the front seat with my youth pastor. He's driving, and we see this car wrapped around a telephone pole. And we're like, man, whoever was in that car, like, did not make it. The next day, I'm at basketball practice. I come home. My parents sit me down, and they said, Chad, last night there was a car accident. Your friend Justin was driving. Now, you don't know who Justin is, but let me let you know who he is. Me and him collected comic books in the fifth grade. And I introduced drugs to him for the first time in the eighth grade. And so my friend Justin, comic book Justin, was driving the vehicle. There was a girl in the front seat, passenger seat, that I didn't know who she was. And Vinny was behind her in the back, behind the passenger seat. They were doing nitrous and speed, going 80 miles an hour, hit a telephone pole straight on without braking. Justin died on impact, hit his heart on the steering wheel, and exploded. The girl went through the windshield. She was in ICU. She was going to make it. Vinny, on the other hand, was clinging to life, less than a 10% chance of living because he had the nitrous tank. The nitrous tank hit him in the face, took off most of his face, they had to sew his nose on, punctured his lung, was in a coma, and his brain was swelling. So he had internal bleeding, brain was swelling, in a coma. And because of being in a coma, they couldn't give him antibiotics. They couldn't give him stuff because it would cause his brain to swell more. So the doctors are like, hey, this is like a death sentence. So I go surfing because that's where I hear God the strongest in my life. I'm out surfing and I'm like, God, what do you want me to do? And he goes, Chad, you know what you need to do. You need to go to that hospital and ask for forgiveness for having hate for your best friend. And then you need to forgive Vinny for stabbing you in the back. So I go. And, you know, the family knows what's going on between me and Vinny, Vinny's family. And I'm going, okay, how are they going to treat me? How are they going to receive me? I walk in the hospital and they begin to just grab me and hug me. And they begin to say, the other nurses and doctors, this is his other brother. He needs to go in there and say goodbye. So the nurse brings me in there. He's hooked up to all these machines. He's orange. He's purple. He's blue. He's discolored. He's fighting all these infections. He's hooked up to all these machines. And I say, Vinny, Vinny. And suddenly when he hears my voice, he starts going into like a seizure, like, you know, where his limbs are going crazy. His heart is going through the roof. And they rush me out of the room. They're like, hey, he recognizes your voice. Like, he's responding to your voice. And I'm going, yeah, he's probably thinking I'm in there to kill him. So he calms down and I walk in there. I walk into the hospital room and I have this, you know, this awareness, like, man, he could hear me. And so I just sit there and I just start weeping. Because it was in that moment that I discovered underneath the hate, the anger, was this incredible amount of love. And I began to just weep over him saying, Vinny, you're my brother. You're my brother. I'm so sorry that I carried hate towards you. I'm so sorry that I beat you up. I'm so sorry. Will you forgive me? And then I began to tell him, Vinny, I forgive you for falsely accusing me that I stole that money with you, for separating me and my dad, causing conflict in our relationship. I forgive you. And I say, Vinny, it's not too late. Jesus is right there. You just run to him. You wrap your arms around him. You put your head on his chest, and that you make him your best friend, your Lord and Savior. It's not too late. And tears are coming down his face. We leave the hospital, and a couple hours later, I get a phone call, and it's Vinny on the phone. Comes out of his coma, and he calls me, and he says, Chad, I heard you. And when you said, Jesus is right there, I saw him in the distance, and I ran what felt like miles. And the moment I got to him, I wrapped my arms around him. He wraps his arms around me. I put my head on his chest. And the moment I put my head on his chest is the moment I came out of my coma. The deal is, it's not a coincidence who you do life with. Please don't take it lightly. Fight for friendships. And God is the God of restoration. Maybe you had a friendship, a relationship, and the bridge blew up. It's not too late. There's these weird two lies, right? Like time heals all wounds. So you let it simmer. You let it rest. You let it sit. And then suddenly you cross over to this other lie of, well, I should just bury the hatchet. I should just let it go. I shouldn't bring it up. It's too weird. It's too awkward. And then you suddenly start developing relationships with other people when all the while the God of restoration wants to crash in. It's not too late for that bridge to be rebuilt. This is a very quick last story. I had the privilege of being a junior high pastor, and we saw kids walk on water. We saw people getting out of wheelchairs. We saw cancer dissolve. We saw blind eyes open, deaf ears open. It was amazing. And we had all kinds of other miracles as well. And I'm going to tell you one of them is we had this 12-year-old who would get into fights. And so I called him into the office, and I'm like, hey, man, what's going on? Like, what's going on in your heart? And he starts weeping. He says, my parents got a divorce about 8 months ago. And I live with my dad now, and my other brother and sister, they live with my mom. So not only am I separated from my mom, I'm separated from my brother and sister. And I look at him and I say, you know what? You're a powerful person. You're called to be a world changer, and your world is your family. So what we're going to do is we're going to meet together, we're going to pray, and I'm going to help you come up with a strategy to be a powerful person and to begin to influence your family. 12 years old. So I'm like, let's just start with your brother. What's the biggest conflict you have with your brother? And he's like, oh, well, when we hang out on Saturday, it's the Xbox. Who's going to play like the game first? Who's going to sit in the best chair? Who's going to, you know, all this stuff. And I'm like, okay, I want you to come up with a game plan to rebuild the bridge and rebuild equity with your brother. And so the next week he comes over and he's like, man, we had the best weekend ever. Like when he came over, I had the game ready. I said, hey, here's your favorite chair. Here's your favorite food. You know, like, and his brother's like, man, am I going to get slimed? Like, what's going to happen here? Like, you know, like, did you set up a bear trap in the couch? Like, what's going on? And they had the most incredible time together. You know, then a couple months later, you know, like he's continually every week doing stuff. And a couple months later, his mom comes up to me and goes, hey, does he need money for like a field trip, like going to like Disneyland or something like that? Or, you know, does he need money for something? And I go, well, no, there's nothing going on like that. Why do you ask? He's like, well, it's not my birthday. It's not Mother's Day. And he's been writing me these cards and telling me the reasons why he loves me and the reason why he's so happy and appreciative that I'm his mom. And I'm like, oh, no, that's just your son just wanting to build a relational equity with you. He's just trying to communicate. He loves you. About a month or two later, his dad comes over to me, who doesn't really go to church, but we're just picking him up from youth group. He goes, hey, I just need to ask you a question. Like, we kind of had a weird moment, me and my son. I had one of the worst days of work. I come home, I'm sitting on the table, and my son comes over to me, puts his arms around me, and he begins to tell me things that I have told no one. And I begin to weep, and my son comforted me. That feels a little strange. Like, what is that? Like, I should be comforting him, and he's comforting me. And I'm like, no. And I didn't even go into the prophetic or anything. I just said, that's your son saying that he loves you, that he values you, that he's investing in the relationship. So about a good 4 or 5 months into this, I'm in my weekly meeting with him, and he comes in, and he starts crying. And I'm like, man, what's going on? He goes, well, my mom went on a date last night. And I'm thinking, okay, hey, divorced family, like new mom, new dad, I'm going to help you navigate through this. And he goes, no, no, you don't understand. My mom went on a date with my dad last night. And we just worshiped. We got on our knees and we worshiped one of the most pure forms of worship, worshiping the God of restoration. And we got to watch his parents fall in love again and get remarried. We have a God of restoration. He rebuilds bridges. He restores bridges. So just put your hand on your heart. It's noon. It's almost time to get the kids. Just put your hand on your heart for a moment. Lord, I just pray that you would restore bridges in this room. The God of restoration would come wherever there's been bridges in our past that have been blown up. I pray, Lord, that you give us creative ideas. Maybe it's a text message. Maybe it's taking someone out to eat. Maybe it's sending someone a card. Maybe it's sending somebody flowers. Whatever it is, I just pray for creative ways to rebuild bridges, that you wouldn't take it lightly, that you wouldn't let another, like today's the perfect day for restoration. And my other prayer is that you'd begin to recognize the Jonathans, the Davids in your life, that I know this leadership team, talking to them yesterday, that this is their heartbeat, this is their value, is that we would be a community that champions one another, that makes covenant with one another, that are friends, that don't take it lightly, that we fight for one another. What does it look like modeling the greatest manifestation of love, that we lay down our lives for one another? So, Lord, that you would show us in which ways, how can we model laying down our lives for one another? And that we would say yes to not just a season, not just a few years, not just a few decades, but we would say yes for eternity. That you would connect our hearts. And we would say yes to relationship. We would say yes when it's inconvenient. We would say yes when we feel hurt, when we feel offended. And we would fight for relationship. We would fight for friendship. We would fight for those that we have history with. So, Lord, just wreck us really, really good. I love you guys. What an honor and a privilege to be here. It's time to get the kids. Before you do, I just want to encourage you, if you could just text, if you could just SMS a person in your life that you're thankful, that's in your life, that's a covenant friendship, it's a Jonathan in your life, I want you just to text someone today and say, hey, I'm so thankful, I'm in church, or, you know, I'm just thinking about you, whatever way you want to say it, but I want you just to text someone today and say, hey, I'm so thankful that you're in my life, and then I want you to text someone else that you haven't talked to in 3 months or more. You know what? Let's just take a moment and get out your phone, and I want you to first text someone that you haven't texted in 3 months or more. Just get out your phones in church. So just I want you just to take this moment. If you need to go get your kids, go get your kids, but please text message somebody, and then I want you to text message someone else that this was the easy one, low-hanging fruit. Text someone that you're thankful that they're in your life right now. But I want you to first text someone that you have not talked to in 3 months or longer. It doesn't mean that there's like a blow up. It just may be somebody that you haven't, you know, I want you to be intentional and say, hey, just thinking about you. Miss you. Whatever language you want to use, just use it in a place of, hey, I value you. I'm thankful for you. Good. I love it. I love seeing the phones break out. So, Lord, I just pray that this would be the beginning. Lord, that we would be powerful people that communicate, hey, this bridge got blown up, but on my side of the bridge, it's open for construction. So, Lord, I just pray for the God of restoration to break in. And I pray, Lord, for covenant relationships. I pray for Jonathan-David relationships that we would fight for one another. Amen. All right, love you guys. You guys are amazing. We'll have my team come on up here if they want. If you guys want prayer, and I don't know, do we have a prayer team? Yeah. Well, we'll have a prayer team come on up. And if you need a miracle in your body, you just want some encouragement, come on up here. We'd love to pray for you. Can't wait for tonight. Is there anything else I need to say? Or you guys want to say, bless you guys. Come on up if you want prayer. We'll see you soon. Thank you so much for having me. Love you guys.